Welcome to Poor Decisions, a podcast about craft beverages from an insider's point of view. Our primary focus is wine made in the Midwest, but topics include other craft beverages and products. Basically, anything that you can pour is fair game. I'm Brian Lesperance, the host of Poor Decisions. I'm happy to be here with you today. This is an AMA. This is AMA number 3. So this format's a little bit different. It's been just me for the first two, and it continues with that trend on number 3. So today we're going to cover a topic that's been on our minds a lot lately at Fen Valley, where I work for my day job, because we just recently expanded our production capabilities in the sparkling area. So in addition to that being a topic of conversation around town here, it's also something that I do get a lot of questions about. So I'm going to try to demystify some of the different things surrounding sparkling wine, including the different techniques for producing it, how that may affect what's in the bottle, how it may affect the cost, and also basically how to open sparkling wine, which will be, you know, more of a YouTube-centric tutorial, since those listening will have a little trouble following, but we'll do my best to describe it. And then we'll wrap up with a tasting of one of Fen Valley's, just that will kind of illustrate a few of the different techniques and types of things that we can do in the sparkling wine production. So that's kind of the itinerary for today. Again, the AMAs are not our normal format. Normally, we try to get some guests in here, and I'm not usually the main attraction, but bear with me today as I'm all you got. So we're going to get right into this thing with rosé, with sparkling wine. I have a rosé sparkling wine. That's why it was on my mind. We did a rosé AMA, if you want to check that one out, because there's some parallels as far as the wine I brought today, if you want to start there. Anyway, let's get right into this. So basically, there's a few different techniques for making sparkling wine, and there's some overlap, although unlike when I did the rosé AMA, there's probably less kind of nuance between the different types of methods for making sparkling wine. And let's just define sparkling wine for today as wine that has a lot of carbon dioxide in it. I'm not going to get into the details of the specific atmospheres of pressure, but much higher than cider. And so we're talking about sort of that kind of thing. We're going to touch on a couple of techniques that are sort of in that vein, but I'm primarily going to focus today on like the three really more mainstream ways in which sparkling wine is made and how they differ. Because those are the things that you're going to encounter on a daily basis. And they're the things that you can use to shop for wine, or if you're a winemaker, to think about the types of sparklers that you might make in your facility. So I'm going to focus there. I may touch on other stuff. We'll see where we get. So big picture, there are three different types of kind of mass production methods for making sparkling wine. And we now have experience with all three firsthand. So I'm pretty comfortable kind of with the ins and outs of them. The first one is the traditional one, and that is the method de Champenois. And that method is the most complex, the most labor intensive, and the most kind of handcrafted, I guess you could say. It also, that tends to come with the highest price tag. So we'll dig into that one a little bit. Then you've got the cuvée method, which is still pretty darn handcrafted. We're going to have to dig into it a little bit deeper here in a little bit. That's the method, one of the methods that we just added the capacity to handle. And then there's what I call the forced carbonation method, or and that method is the most kind of modern, and it gives you the kind of the lowest cost of goods, maybe the most control, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But let's start with the base. So regardless of the method that you're going to go through, you need to make a base wine first for these three methods. And so there's some things that you're going to look for, generally speaking, if you're looking to make a base for sparkling. If it's going to be done in the traditional method, the champagne method, or the cuvée method, or the Charmat method, you're going to want to basically be picking fruit that's slightly underripe, usually, because you want to start with lower sugars and low kind of reduced flavor, more bright, crisp, clean flavors versus that fully mature, higher sugar grape that you might be looking for a still wine. And there's a couple reasons for that. The main reason, sort of logistically speaking, is that both the champagne method and the Charmat method are going to necessitate a second fermentation using a small amount more yeast and sugar in order to produce the bubbles via fermentation, so naturally. And so you need to have a lower sugar and the base juice to make the base wine so that your alcohols are low enough after your primary fermentation to get a secondary fermentation started, because yeast doesn't like a super alcoholic environment. In fact, starting these secondary fermentations is a trick. We'll talk a little bit about it at the high level, but it's definitely something where a winemaker is going to lose a little sleep, is going to have to be real careful with getting that second fermentation started up, which again, I'll talk about that in a minute, but that's kind of where you want to start. The higher acid, kind of lower flavor, really comes into the play with the fact that you're adding a lot of carbonation, and carbonic acid is going to, it kind of highlights all the other stuff going on. So if you have any flavor in the wine, it's going to boost it in a lot of ways through all those bubbles. It's going to carry the aromatic up into the nose. It's going to, you know, be really vibrant on your palate. So the underripe fruit plays a nice role in that. And that's where, you know, a cool climate like Michigan is awesome for making sparklers, because we can come in and we can pick, I'll just use an example of Chardonnay, because it's probably the one that we could put in all these categories and it would stand up pretty well. You know, you can come in and pick maybe we call it glean pick. So you go out in the vineyard, you take off some of the fruit, maybe a week, 2 weeks before full maturity, and that becomes the fruit that you use for sparkling wine. So you end up leaving a little extra fruit out there knowing that you're going to come in and take some off. So it allows you to kind of dual purpose that vineyard for getting your early pick for sparkling and then come in later when the vineyard is fully mature and pick the stuff for still wine. So it's an efficient use of your vineyard. It can be a way to manage crop load. It can be a way to leverage really a cooler climate where you do get good flavor development fairly early in the ripening window. So you're still going to get nice, bright fruit flavors, even though your sugars are going to be quite a bit less than they would be when you're going to pick it for still wine. Then you do a generally pretty standard fermentation, what we call primary fermentation, which is where you're going to be taking the base juice and fermenting it to dryness. Okay. And so your alcohols, again, we would like to see them usually right around 10%, you know, plus or minus a little bit. That's where kind of where we'd like to see stuff. So we're probably starting with about 18 to 20 bricks at harvest, with good, you know, acidity, probably, you know, around 1%, and, you know, nice flavor, but a little bit muted. The only thing you really have to watch out for, I think, in your primary is just your use of sulfur, because you are going to be doing a secondary fermentation. So you definitely want to be light-handed with anything like sulfur that's going to make fermentation harder down the road. But there's a lot of organic material in those primary fermentation, including all the dead yeast. So I'm not too concerned about that. I wouldn't deviate super far from protocol. The other thing that we often do with sparkling production is do what's called a whole cluster press. And so instead of crushing and pressing the berries to create a must and then pumping that into the press, you'll actually just dump whole berries in the press and squeeze them that way, which reduces the skin contact time. And that is, again, because you're exemplifying or accentuating, rather, all of the flavors. And skin flavors can be rather bitter. And so adding all that carbonation in there, you're going to really taste those skin flavors. So it takes longer to fill the press with whole fruit versus fruit that's been crushed, because you've got a lot of air in between the berries. And so it is more labor intensive, but it definitely is the way to go if you're going to make a premium sparkler. And that is exactly how I've seen it done in most cases, and certainly how we do it. Poor Decisions is presented by Fen Valley Consulting Services. Fen Valley Services is a specialized division of Fen Valley Vineyards dedicated to providing expert winery management and consulting services. With over 50 years of industry experience, we help farmers, winemakers, and wine marketers build successful, sustainable businesses. As a trusted winery management company, we offer customized, consultative solutions tailored to the unique needs of each client. Whether you need assistance with winery or tasting or operations, complete winemaking services, e-commerce support, or something else wine-related, our team of experts provides the experience and hands-on support needed to elevate your winery success. Learn more at www.fenvalley.com. Okay, so now we got the base wine made. And we're going to now decide, we're going to make that into a sparkler. Let's start with the champagne method. So in the champagne method, there's a couple things going on here that makes it really, really unique and really special. Basically, we're going to start creating a starter. And I'm not going to get too much in the weeds on this one because everyone has some different theories or some really good protocols out there. If you're in the wine industry, you can go to any of your vendors, and a lot of the vendors that provide the yeast and the nutrition and other things that you're going to add will have protocols that you can use as a baseline template. And then you can kind of tweak it from there. And if anybody out there has questions about this, feel free to reach out. Just go to craftpourdecisions.com and there's a contact us section and you can throw in your questions and we'd be happy to connect you up with some resources because we want to see everybody be successful with this. And it is a bit of a trick because you're basically trying to slowly acclimate the yeast to a pretty toxic environment. Even though we're trying to run those alcohols a little lower, it's still not the easiest on the yeast to start up a fermentation when you're already have that much alcohol present. And so what you do is you build a starter that is kind of how you get things going. Then you keep adding to the starter. And again, there's various protocols out there. But at the end of the day, you then have a base of fermenting wine that you add a certain amount of sugar to. And this is all calculated because you want to add enough to create the right amount of bubble, but not too much where the fermentation is going to stall out, and not too little where you don't create enough carbon dioxide. So this is something you're really watching carefully. A lot of you know, hard work and time goes into getting this right. Now you think you've got a good fermenting batch going here. So you've got your secondary fermentation underway, and now you have a very small window to take that fermenting product and get it into a bottle. Because if you wait too long, that's carbon dioxide escaping into the open, you know, into the tank that the fermentation's happening in to get it started. So this has to be carefully coordinated between, you know, the packaging team and the winemaking team, or if they're one and the same, they got to be ready. You know, your glass has got to be ready. Your line's got to be tested and ready to go. So you're going to be fill into a special bottle, champagne bottle, and you're going to put a crown cap on after you fill it. Okay, because now we're going to have to get, we'll get there in a second, but you put a crown cap on. And then traditionally, you're going to then lay those bottles on their side. So we use these wire rat cages that are really great for storing about 500 bottles at a piece on their side. So, and the reason for that is after fermentation, so now your second fermentation just sort of goes along in the bottle. The biggest thing to watch out for there is temperature. You don't want it to be too hot. You don't necessarily want it to be too cold. Nice cellar temperature is good, you know, 55, 65, just like you'd want for a primary fermentation, so that you get a nice even fermentation across the board. And you're going to monitor this every now and again to just see how it's going, make sure it's started in each bottle, basically. Not, you can check each bottle, but you can be reasonably sure if you had a good homogeneous bottling that every bottle is about the same. And eventually, your checking is going to lead you to figure out that it's dry again. In other words, all the sugar, all the secondary sugar, or sometimes called priming sugar, has been fermented. And when you're trying the product, it should be bubbly. Now, the bubbles at that point are going to be kind of harsh. They're going to be kind of big and noticeable. And that's okay. That's what you'd expect right now. Then you're just going to let it go. So it's going to sit in those cages on its side for how long, it depends. It's up to the winemaker, really. The longer it lasts on, this is called enturage, when we're just letting it rest on its side. What's happening is the yeast is spreading out along the bottom, and not unlike a surly aged wine in barrel, which is another AMA for another day, that yeast starts to break down in the presence of the alcohol in the wine. And some of that yeast, you know, cell structure, which is made up of amino acids, will ultimately end up in the wine that creates some structure. It gives it that slightly more mouth enveloping sensation, which is what a lot of your champagnes, one of the characteristics that differentiates them from some of these other methods that we're going to talk about. It's also, the longer you go, you're going to get more of that. You're going to get more of the pastry notes, you know, the yeasty kind of bread dough characteristics of some of those really classic champagne style wines, or champagnes if they actually are made in the Champagne region of France. And so rule of thumb, probably at least 36 months in Tirage to really start to see that happen. If you want a more fruit-driven wine, but you still want to use the champagne method, then you're going to do a shorter Tirage. You're going to do a Tirage that might only be a year, in which case you're going to get less of the yeast character and more of the fruit character. And that is certainly a winemaker's choice. We do both. We are our kind of classic champagne blend. And a classic champagne blend is going to be Chardonnay as the base with Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier blended into the base. Pinot Meunier adds a lot of structural elements. It's a wonderful grape to add to your champagne program as a result. It also makes a really nice rosé on the years that you're not using it for sparkling. If you do a Blanc de Blanc, it's usually traditionally just Chardonnay. And if you're doing Blanc de Noir, it's either just Pinot Noir, just Pinot Meunier, or usually a combination of the two. And they're all great for different reasons. So now you've done your Tirage and you decide, okay, it's time to get this ready for the customer. So you have a big problem, which is that you have yeast in the bottle that you probably want out because people expect this brilliantly clear, bubbly, sparkling wine. And so you end up going into the next phase of the process called riddling. And riddling is where you start to work the yeast into and down the neck and into the area where the screw cap or the not screw cap, the capsule is rather. And sometimes you place a little piece of plastic in there called a bidule that you place in at packaging. It helps to sort of capture that yeast and sort of hold it in the neck area. You don't have to do that. It just usually reduces your losses during packaging. And again, that bidule is placed into the neck of the bottle before you place the cap on top, the crown cap on top. All right. So then you would typically set the bottle at an angle of, depending on the strategy, it could just be straight upside down. It could be about 30% or 30 degrees. And you're going to rotate the bottle with some degree of frequency. Every winery has their little different strategies here. And in the classic champagne region, I've not had an opportunity to watch this up close, but essentially it will, you know, be rotated with some degree of regularity to try to work that yeast into the very end of the bottle. And I can speak from experience, some of these, and it's called riddling, some bottles riddle very easily and it's just, they're ready to go after a few weeks and we're off to the next phase. Others can be real stubborn and that yeast is still stuck in the neck and you can see it. If you hold the wine bottle up to the light, you'll see this little subtle amount of residue sitting on the neck of the bottle and all you can do is keep working it. Sometimes you have to be more aggressive and sort of mixing everything back up again and kind of starting from scratch. Sometimes it's just another turn and you're going to get that last bit into the end of the neck. But ultimately that's where we're going with this, is we're trying to get all that yeast into the end. Then we're going to get to the next phase, which is called disgorgement. Bottles are gradually tilted basically straight up and down. So now the crown cap is facing down and the neck is frozen. Okay, so there's various tools for that job, but you want to freeze that yeast so that when you open the crown cap, you remove the crown cap, the pressure of the CO2 will push what looks like a plug of encapsulated yeast. It's encapsulated in the frozen wine around it. And that is critical because you want to get all that yeast out with as little loss of wine as possible. And this is where a lot of technique can play into this because you want to try to get from that point where you open the bottle to the machine that you're going to dosage on, which is the next phase, as efficiently as you can, because wine will be wanting to leave that bottle. Again, it's pretty cold, so if you do it right, your losses are pretty manageable. At that point, you have an opportunity to tweak the chemistry in the bottle. So if you want to make this wine a little bit sweet, you can add when what's called a dosage, can be, which is the wine you're going to use to refill the bottle, can be made really sweet. So you can add a little sugar at that point. Sometimes we'll do a little acid tweak. Sometimes people add a little sulfur dioxide at that point. There's a lot of different techniques. If you go all natural, that means you're just going to use more of the dry sparkling wine to refill the bottle. And the dosage is what this is that you're making up, is how you're kind of deciding what's going to go into that final bottle. And the way it works is you say, okay, if I want to be at X percent sugar in the final product, then I know I'm losing at least, let's just say, you know, 3 millimeters of liquid, or milliliters of liquid rather, through the process of opening the bottle. So my dosage might be 2 mil, and then the balance will get made up with the other wine, so that you're always adding exactly the same amount of sweet liquid to the wine. Otherwise, they'd be wildly different sweetness levels based on how much wine had expelled from the bottle during the process of popping off that crown cap and getting it back onto the dosage machine. So there's a lot there. And, you know, we do a lot of stuff brut or natural because we just like dry sparklers. So we're rarely doing much in the dosage. So it's pretty straightforward. But I have done plenty where we're adding some stuff there. And it's not hard. You just have to do the math and make sure the equipment is configured correctly and calibrated correctly, so that you're going to put a good consistent amount of dosage in each bottle to make sure that each bottle has reached the same amount of sweetness in the end. All right, then it comes off of the dosage machine and you immediately apply the cork. The cork is a special kind of cork, obviously, that has a lot of material that does not get all the way into the bottle, because the next phase is you're going to apply the wire hood, which is basically the safety on the mechanism. We'll get to opening bottles at the end, and you'll see all this stuff if you're watching on YouTube. If not, I'll try to describe it. And then it's ready to go. So it's really cold though at that point. So usually the label can't go on right away. So usually it goes back into a cage, lays around for a little bit, gets warmed back up. Then it runs through the packaging line to apply a foil if desired. The foil doesn't really do anything. It's just more of a, makes it look pretty, can keep the hood from getting dusty and moldy if over time, but it's not required. A lot of wineries don't use them anymore, or they get really nice custom hoods that's kind of cool too. But nonetheless, you have to put a label on it if you're going to sell it to a customer. So you got to wait to do that. So you can really see, we're talking from picking the grapes to selling that wine could easily be 4 or 5 years. So it's one of the reasons why these wines are so sought after, why they are more expensive often, and why they're somewhat rare. But there's advantages. You're going to have the most complex flavors. You're going to have the most nuance. You're going to have a finer bubble, because all that aging in the bottle creates a bubble that's very silky, very smooth, very appealing to the palate. But again, you're paying for that in time and in hand labor, really, through the whole process. Now, big producers have machines that can do some of this stuff, to be sure, but smaller producers are doing a lot of the things that I've been describing by hand. And so it definitely adds to the cost of the product. But they're great. They're some of my favorites out there. Okay. And if you do it in the United States, or not in Champagne, you can't call it Champagne, but you can put Méthode de Champenois on the bottle. So if you're listening to this podcast as a consumer and you're interested in wines made in this technique, most producers are going to disclose that on the bottle, often on the front label, sometimes on the back, but they're going to be proud of that because of all the things I just described. And therefore, they're going to disclose it. So you should be able to figure that out. Okay. The next technique, which I would say is really popular, is what's called the Charmat method, or the tank method. And in this case, it's a faster, more cost-effective method, which is the most famous wines made in this method are Proseccos from Italy. And basically, in this case, you have a large pressure vessel, so kind of like a bright tank for beer or hard cider, but much more aggressive than that. It has thicker stainless steel because we're talking about much higher pressures than we would be with those other products. It has cooling jackets in order to keep the wine cold when it comes to packaging, just like a bright tank would have. They often have stirrers to stir up the liquid, which we'll get to in a minute. They often have heaters because sometimes this fermentation can get kind of sluggish. But the basic idea is we're going to do the same thing we were going to do for the Champagne method as far as making a starter and getting the base wine to start fermenting. But instead of putting the liquid into individual bottles, we're going to put it into the pressure tank and lock it shut. And in that case now, the CO2 can't escape. It gets pressurized in the tank. So it's quite a bit more efficient because you've now got one big fermentation instead of hundreds or thousands of little ones. You also have the ability to, again, to control temperature and to control the yeast kind of staying active. That's where the stirring can come in handy. It's not required. I know a lot of the older tanks certainly don't have all these fancy bells and whistles. It just makes it sometimes faster and more consistent. But nonetheless, it's a really cool method for getting this naturally created bubble. So the bubble's still coming from the fermentation, but now we have a different set of problems and opportunities. So now we know it's done, so we can test it. There's a special sampling valve that can handle all that pressure that's built up in the tank, and we can tell that the wine is dry. Now we have to still get the yeast out. So there's a couple different techniques, but the basic protocol is to chill the wine down, okay, because the fermentation's done. The dead yeast is going to want to start settling to the bottom of the tank. And so much like a primary fermentation, you're basically going to try to rack off of that dead yeast. But here's the problem. The tank's under pressure. And if we open the tank, we're going to lose all the pressure, which would defeat the whole purpose of doing a second fermentation in the first place. So the way to do it is you have to have another Charmat tank paired to this one, which you then start by pressurizing to basically the same pressure as the pressure in the tank with the liquid in it, just a slightly lower amount. I mean, we're talking very slightly lower because you want the liquid to flow to the tank with less pressure. And you'll set it up through a filter. So whatever doesn't get settled out through racking will then get filtered out through what basically we call this counter pressure, because we've pressurized the receiving vessel to equalize with the source vessel so that the CO2 has nowhere to go. And then you hook them together. So as the liquid basically leaves one tank and goes to the other, it's displacing pressurized CO2 in the receiving tank, and the CO2's got to go somewhere. It goes back to the other tank. So you're basically just inverting them and doing it through special hoses that can handle pressure, special clamps that can handle pressure, and a filter that's set up to handle pressure. And so everything happens in this closed system. And now you have a pressurized tank of finished wine that is devoid of all of its yeast and ready for packaging. Now, you could add sugar at that point to the tank. There's various ways to do this under pressure so that you can have a sweeter wine again, just like we did with the addition of the dosage. So it's a little more controllable because the machinery for dosaging is great, but you're doing it per bottle. So there's always a chance for some variation there, where in this case, we're going to homogenize our desired residual sugar into the tank pre-bottling. And then you're going to have to bottle in a counter pressure fashion. So these are bottling lines that are quite different than your typical gravity fill, because now you're going to pressurize the bottle to be equal to the tank, or just slightly less actually, so that the liquid flows into a bottle that already has pressurized carbon dioxide in it. Therefore, the CO2 suspended in the liquid doesn't want to leave. The other key is to make it very cold. You see, cold liquid can hold more gas than warm liquid. It's the same reason why when you open a soda I didn't realize it was warm, it wants to gush out. Same thing with beer, because that CO2 can't stay in solution when the solution is warm. So we get it real cold, and that really helps to keep what we call breakout, which is the CO2 escaping the liquid. It really helps to keep the breakout down, especially, and when you do it with counter pressure, you should have zero loss going through your counter pressure filler. As you even take it off of the filler, you have slowly brought that liquid in under pressure, and therefore there's no liquid spewing out of that bottle when then it goes to the next phase, where it gets the same treatment as the champagne method. Gets the cork, gets the hood, then it has to warm back up, because again, the liquid's very cold, before it then gets labeled and optionally placed onto the capsule. So that's the Charmat method. You're going to get a little more fruit-driven wine, because while you do have some yeast contact, you don't have a lot of it. And so you're going to have more fruity wines. That's why Proseccos tend to exhibit that kind of bright fruitiness. The bubble is going to be more harsh than the champagne method, but still pretty silky, pretty smooth, pretty great. So it's a really nice process. I think it's one of those things where there's a great opportunity to make a handcrafted wine in a little more efficient fashion using the Charmat method. And that's one of the methods that we have now just started being able to do at Fen Valley, which is awesome. It's much faster. Of course, we're talking a few weeks usually, and it's less complex. You do have slightly shorter sort of shelf life, again, slightly larger bubble. There is a method that I'm not super familiar with, but in researching for this episode, called the transfer method. I'm not really familiar with it intimately, but essentially it's a hybrid of traditional and Charmat, where the second fermentation happens in a bottle, but then you skip riddling and disgorging. So you basically do it in a bottle, and then I guess you transfer it to the pressure tank, which to me seems totally insane, but I guess people do it. I've never done it, but it's been done, I suppose. There's kind of a, before I get into the last method, there are some kind of ancestral methods like pet knots, that I'm not going to get into today, but essentially you're bottling towards the end of your primary fermentation and not allowing the liquid or the rest, the fermentation finishes in a bottle, the primary fermentation finishes in the bottle. So you get your carbonation through that. They typically are unfiltered at that point. So they're hazy. They can be great, but they can also, you know, they can be kind of what they are. They're often done with natural fermentations. We've done them and they can be really good. That's not a traditional method, not something you're going to see a whole lot. So I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole too far today. Maybe we'll do a pet knot episode with a guest who makes them and they can really talk us through some of the pros and cons. We've made a few, so I've definitely have some experience, but it's not something we do all the time. But again, they tend to be rustic, cloudy, really kind of fun and funky, but certainly not mainstream. Okay, so the last method that I'm going to talk about today is basically the carbonation method, forced carbonation method. This is the simplest and cheapest. It is where basically we make a base wine, we put it in the Charmat tank, and then we just start forcing carbonation in through a carbing stone, just like you would do for hard cider, for beer. It's a very straightforward method. It has some serious advantages. For example, you're dialing in exactly the carbonation level you want. You're dialing in exactly the residual sugar you want. You don't have to start with a lower alcohol base wine. So you could make this decision later on in the winemaking process. You know, we're making decisions about sparkling wine in the vineyard, obviously, because we're farming that block for the champagne and the Charmat method from the beginning of this growing season. Where if you have a batch of wine that maybe feels like it could be a good base for sparkling, you could make that call whenever you want if you're doing the carbonation method, because what you have in the bottle is what you're going to get. So your higher alcohol stuff can survive, obviously, having CO2 pumped into it. It will create a harsher, bigger bubble. So the customer experience will be different because it won't be that fine, silky bubble that you get from the champagne method and even from the Charmat method. But again, it is a great technique for producing stuff that's, you know, very simple, very straightforward, and or very dialed in. If you have a very specific requirement for what you're trying to do, this is the easiest way to do it. It's also a way to make sparkling that's not super expensive. So if you're in the industry and you're looking to make something that you might even put in a keg to use for mixer with, you know, a mimosa or a cocktail that you're making, if you're a producer that has a distillery license too and you can do cocktails on site, you could make a base of sparkling this way just to keg up and have available on tap, so you're not going to be burning a bunch of money on bottles that you really don't need if you're just serving on premise, because your sparkling bottles are the most expensive because they have to withstand all of that pressure. So it's a lot of glass and they are, you know, not as commonly produced. So you just have less supply and demand to bring down those overall costs. So there's a lot to think about there if you're on the production side. From a consumer side, you know, I think it really comes down to what you like and which and where you see value. If you're grabbing a bottle to mix with orange juice on a Sunday morning, I wouldn't suggest going cheap because the sparkling wine is still the biggest component of that beverage. And so you're going to want something that can carry itself for sure. But because you're pairing it with a sweet beverage, whether it's, you know, like an orange juice or like if you do something more with like peach or something, I would go with something more fruit driven. So I love this Charmat method for this, or even the forced carb method, because you're going to get a fruitier base that is going to kind of work with the fruitiness of your non-alcoholic addition. If you're doing more of a cocktail, you know, again, Charmat or champagne might be a really good method because that complexity from the yeast influence might be a component of that beverage that is really quite nice. There's a lot of examples of that in the spirits world that I'd like to dig into on another episode with maybe a mixologist who can come here and really give us an education on that. I would go dry in those situations because you can dial up the sweetness with the additional fruit juice that you're adding. So you're going to start with a dry base and then you're really dialing it in versus starting with something with residual where you're going to have two variables you're playing with. When I say that though, anything in the semi-dry category, I would count as dry for the purposes of blending for something like that, because you're not talking about a whole lot of sugar there compared to what you're putting in with whatever you're mixing it up with. The champagne method, again, is great if you're looking for something that's super complex, that you know is handcrafted, that will give you that experience that is really special. And they're not all super expensive, because there's a lot of us that are doing it enough where we've been able to bring the cost down a little bit. And we like to see it in the hands of consumers. And we know in order to do that, we've got to make it at a price point that isn't just for, you know, special occasions. And that's a big trend I'm seeing in the industry throughout my travels and just in working, is sparkling is on a tear. It is one of our most noticeably growing segments of wine. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. They tend to be honestly wonderful food wine. They're probably unsung heroes in the kitchen because that crisp acidity and bubble can really help to keep the palate cleansed through a meal. They have a lot of versatility in how they can be paired with food. So don't hesitate to try to think of ways to use them in the kitchen. If you're a consumer listening to this or someone running a restaurant, there's a great opportunity there. Also, again, for you Midwest producers of wine, you know, we are sitting in a perfect climate to make the base fruit that makes sparkling wine. Champagne region of France is cooler than some of the other regions like Burgundy and Bordeaux. They decided to make sparkling because that was a good product to make in that climate. And so we should be thinking about that if you're having especially a cooler year where maybe you're not as happy with the way things are progressing. That might be a year to double down on the sparklers and try some things that you haven't done before in order to try to build a market around it versus to make a still wine that's substandard. So, you know, that's some big picture thoughts, some methods here. I don't have a favorite. It's kind of like, you know, what am I doing today? What makes the most sense? I am going to do a tasting segment today, which I don't usually do on the AMAs, but I wanted to cover a couple things, especially, well, generally for the consumer audience on how to open sparkling wine, because it actually could be dangerous. So we want to practice safety first when we're talking about this. And so the first thing is to make sure it's really cold. And for those who are not watching on YouTube, I've got mine in a bucket of ice right now, and that is a great way to do it. Refrigerator's fine, but just keep in mind that if you take it out of the fridge for a while, it's not going to take it long to come up to a temperature where opening it is going to be far dicier. So I like to start it in ice, add a little water to the ice if it's going to be in there right away, just so it really does power chill that bottle down. And again, that's because we want that CO2 to want to live in the bottle. We don't want it to escape the second that we pull open the cork. So I'm going to grab this bottle. What I brought today is one that we made. because I wanted to showcase that this is actually a rosé sparkler. And so if you want to, as I already plugged this once on the podcast, but we did a rosé AMA a few weeks back that was pretty fun, talking about the different styles of rosé that you can make. And this one is another way to do rosé. So if you want to learn how we made the base for this, just listen to that episode and you'll be able to figure it out. So this is a rosé made from Chambersin, which is a French-American hybrid grape that we grow quite a bit of here in Michigan. It's a wonderfully fruity, low tannin red grape, so it lends itself well to a sparkling wine, because tannin would really be another thing we would not want to see in a sparkler, because just like it's just that skin bitterness, astringency thing, all that stuff is going to get really amplified by the carbon dioxide. And so we really want something that's going to have very little skin influence, and Chambersin does the trick. So I've removed the foil for those not watching, which again is really just more of a cosmetic feature at this point. And so there's nothing I've changed in the safety profile by removing the foil from the bottle. I'm about to change the safety profile by removing the hood. So the wire hood is placed around the neck, and it grabs this special part of the neck that's designed to basically keep that hood on top of the cork itself. And so once I start untwisting this hood, now I need to be worried about this wine, because now if I had either a wine flaw in this where it was maybe overcarbonated, or if the cork was maybe just slightly out of spec and wasn't in as tight as it should be, or it's a really old bottle so that cork has started to naturally compress, it's like a weapon, like a gun that's loaded. We've now taken the safety off. And so we want to make sure that we're pointing that away from any humans, any animals, anything you don't want to break. And so I've got it sitting straight up and down on my desk, which is fine, because, I mean, my ceiling, I've got a few dents in it already, so it's not the end of the world. But if you're concerned about your ceiling, don't point it at your ceiling. Now, I'm going to be in a position now just to stay on the mic where I'm not quite optimized for what I like to do, but I'm going to stand up a little bit and try to move the mic with me just so that people who are watching can actually see. It might be cutting my head off, but that's fine. I like to personally take the bottle down on my hip. So notice I'm carefully not pointing the cork at anybody, but now I've got it down on my hip with the cork facing behind me, again, knowing no one's there, and I've got a towel over the bottle and I'm gripping the cork itself. And this is the real trick. And if you watch the pros, you're always going to see this. I'm now going to twist the bottle. I'm not going to twist the cork much, because I've got a lot more leverage on the bottle than I do on the cork. So it's just going to make for a more consistent removal. And I'm just slowly working that around. I can feel the cork pushing and it's just about to release. This one comes out pretty easy. Sometimes if they've been freshly bottled, those corks are still pretty big, and so you might have to work it a little bit. And for those not watching, I did not spill this all over my MacBook or my audio board. So you can tell I was pretty confident, because I was literally doing it over all of my equipment. And I know this wine pretty well. If you don't know the wine, I would not recommend doing that over any equipment that you care about. I would probably do it over my sink, especially champagnes. I find can be a little less predictable, just because you've got bottle by bottle variation sometimes with champagnes. Also, they may just have more CO2 to begin with. There is a range of carbon dioxide that winemakers will choose to put into these bottles. And so, you know, this one is about middle of the range. So now that it's open, I just brought a regular wine glass today. You know, I do like champagne glasses, this particular glass with its kind of hourglass style is really kind of a good, glass that's sort of all around. Because what you're kind of looking for, if you're interested in how to kind of judge them, is a lot of times you look at the mousse, which is the head that's created during the pour. And again, this is a forced carb product. So what I'm seeing in the mousse are big bubbles, not a lot of mousse. It kind of dissipates quickly. That's very typical of a forced carbonated wine, and would be exactly what I would expect. If I was pouring a champagne method wine, I would expect that mousse to be really fine. I would expect it to hang around quite a bit longer. And when I put my nose in, I expect to smell those pastry notes right off the get-go, where right now what I'm smelling is fruitiness. I'm smelling, and again, that CO2, the design of the glass, you know, gone other than for show are the days of those big, wide, sparkling wine glasses, because what we're trying to do with the glass is to force the aromatic up into your olfactory. And so the shape of that really helps to concentrate what's happening up into your nose. So as I always tell people on the show, don't be afraid to get in there and really smell it, because you know your highest concentration of the volatile aromatic compounds are going to be as close as you can get to that liquid without sucking any up your nostrils, which is no fun. In terms of looking at the bubble, this is where this glass isn't the best, because you just don't have as much volume to see, because we've spread it out more, so you don't have as long of a travel for the bubble. But it's nice to watch the bubbles kind of build off of the glass and kind of work their way up, and you want to see a nice even constant release of bubbles through the wine from bottom to top. Again, a champagne is going to have smaller bubbles. They're going to be coming very consistently, and they're going to last for quite a while. The forced carbonation method is generally going to lead to a shorter period where the bubbles are super pronounced, but they should be there throughout the experience. That's the whole point. We've got a lot of CO2 in there, so that if it takes you 15 minutes to work through the glass, that last sip should still have a noticeable amount of carbonation to it. Otherwise, it was either undercarbonated or, you know, through the pouring process, you sort of over jostled it and worked too much of that carbon dioxide out too early in the process. Or, you know, you shook the bottle and shot half of it across the yard or something like that. So I'm going to, you know, again, I'm going to smell this one. Again, all I'm getting with this is, you know, cherries and raspberries, which is what we'd like to see on this. This is our very fruit driven style. You know, we do all the methods, and this one is really geared for that really kind of fruity, simple, very still dry, but very simple, straightforward, dry sparkler that is also very, very food friendly. I just took a sip, and you know what you should notice, again, how that bubble hits your tongue. This one's assertive. You know that, you know it's there. It's that classic forced carb, where it's a big bubble. Not in a bad way. It's just that's the design. That's the style. If this was a sparkler, it might linger a little bit longer. The finish on this is pure fruit, which is the design of the forced carb. Again, if you do a champagne, you're going to get some probably lingering yeast influence. Some of the pastry notes will come in. I usually get the fruit kind of in the middle of a champagne, and then that front and back tend to be where the yeast comes to the party. And so again, different products give you a whole different experience. And Charmant, again, is often somewhere in between. So yeah, that's basically, you know, the nuts and bolts of sparkling wine from our point of view. It's a fun product. Like I said, don't be afraid of them. You know, get out there and find some great ones. Don't always look for the most expensive ones. I think there's a lot of value in the Charmant method these days, because it is sort of walking that balance, you know, tightrope between the very classic champagne method and then the more modern forced carb method. So again, there's good value in all these methods. They're just different. But don't be afraid to get out there and try some. And if there's any that you really like, please shoot them to us. We'd love to try them out ourselves and see if there's anything that we can learn as an industry from some of them that are really, really doing it well. So with that, again, any questions, we love to get ideas for AMAs. So just go to our website and submit your thoughts on things you want to learn more about, and we'll go deep into them and try to demystify the process, either as for the industry as well as for consumers. We are available on all the platforms, so just look for Poor Decisions on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, everywhere that you can find your podcast, we should be there. And if you want to just check out all the places where you can find us, or get transcripts for the episodes, or again, submit questions, just go to craftpourdecisions.com. And with that, I would just encourage you to get out there, find yourself some sparkling wine, and until next time, cheers.